That's the worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 21 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? I mean, it's really actually, I think, episode 20B, if last week was 20A, because it's a continuation of my chat with Richard Russell. We dealt with his early career, if you listened to the last episode in that episode. And this is sort of widening Kennedy onwards, which encompasses, I think, some of the more significant parts beyond. I mean, I think there was tons of great stuff in the first chat, but I think, you know, if you had an ad that was going to be attached to Richard's name, that's, you know, going to be in his obituary or whatever it is, perhaps slightly less grim than that, it would be Gruer. And we talk a lot about Gruer and how it came about and the overall Widens thing and the overall Honda thing. And there's a lot of great stuff in here to kind of learn from. And we talk about the time after that, including Richard's book on golf. So without further ado, here's part two with Richard Russell. Cool. So this is part two of the chat with Richard. I might put them both up together. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But basically where we left part one was, I think, a really good dividing line, because you were just about to join Widen & Kennedy, or you had just joined Widen & Kennedy, and you told us about the fact that their department was full of kids, and Neil Dawson had recommended to Tony and Kim that you join, and you were the, I guess, I don't want to sound negative, safer pair of hands, in terms of you could give you a brief and you'd know it was cracked, rather than have some kids where that wasn't the case.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I think one of the things that happens with more experienced teams is that they're quicker. They're not necessarily better, but they sort of get there quicker, wherever there is. So yeah, maybe they thought so, but I'm sure, you know, right from the word go, I'm sure Tony and Kim didn't really want too much that was safe in the department. So I don't know, I guess they saw something that meant, and maybe, you know, in some of the earlier stuff I'd done, even if it was unfashionable agencies, that meant maybe I could come up with unexpected solutions. There was only literally 5 or 6 creatives. And there was something rather lovely about being part of this place where there was, 25 people? And we were all trying to work out how the hell to make a success of it. And it's great.
Yeah, I think that was one thing that I wanted to sort of first ask you, because Widen & Kennedy had gone through two not successful attempts with, I think, Nick Gill and Adam Keane beforehand, and then Tony and Kim turned up. Was there something different about the vibe here? Did you feel like it was going to succeed? This was the it failed twice, so I think like people weren't necessarily thinking the odds of success are incredibly high, whatever. Then within a few years, every award in the entire planet had been won many times over. So something was different. Is there any way you can explain about that?
Well, I think there is a forgotten name, actually, from Widen & Kennedy's success, which was the MD, a lady called Amy Smith, an Australian. Right. And she hired Tony Kim. It's like, I'm not sure, I hope I'm wrong about this, but I'm not sure people realise she was the conduit to everything happening, I think. So she hired Tony and Kim. And I think suddenly the management just gelled. And I mean, I don't know anything about what happened before I went there. I don't know what the causes were for it to not succeed. But Amy was this larger-than-life, really smiley, happy, energetic, inspirational figure. She made everybody feel they were wanted, and were doing a great job, and was also, you know, someone you could go and talk to. She wasn't really like any MD or, you know, chief exec, effectively, that I'd ever worked with before. She got on brilliantly with Tony and Kim. She let them do what they do. The three of them were fantastic in new business meetings, because the chemistry they exuded was brilliant. And then she left, it was just before I did. So, and then Neil Christie took over.
Sure.
So Neil has kind of been there many, many years now, over a decade, I think.
Yeah.
But actually, it was Amy that kind of made it happen. And she hired Tony and Kim, So that's a feather in her cap.
Yeah, and you knew Tony and Kim before from BNP. I mean, did you think that they had more in them sort of intrinsically to make this a huge success than perhaps some of the others who'd gone before them, or that they would, it was just that they needed the right set of circumstances and they would, you know, shoot for the stars?
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't realised before I worked for them just how obsessed they were with new original thinking, that if you went to see them with traditional structures for ideas, you were just shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, I haven't really got that from their Lagos work necessarily. I think they themselves felt they were suddenly in a place, and with Dan Wyden, you know, supporting them and believing in them, where they could truly fly and do anything. And I don't think we should underestimate that they were, at the time, one of the rare ECD teams.
Oh, right, yeah.
And in fact, there aren't too many, I don't think, in London, ECD teams. I'm a big fan of ECD teams. Perhaps I would be after my experiences there. I just think they can be there for each other and they can share the load. And they played off each other wonderfully. Because, I mean, I can't quite remember. I don't know where they came from. Was it from Lagos?
I think they went to BBH for in between.
Oh, okay, BBH. So I don't necessarily know that you are expected at BBH. I mean, I've heard people who say the opposite. If anything, the creative directors don't necessarily rule the roost, which seems a bit odd for such a creative agency. I think it's quite an account-led agency, and suddenly. Right. Mm. They found themselves in a absolutely creative-led culture, and they were expected to run with that baton. And I think it was the making of them as well. Allowed them to fly.
Yeah, and I think having been in this position, not to the extent that they have myself, when suddenly there's no one else you have to show your work to, there's no one above. For that first few times that happens, you're almost like disbelieving. What? No one has to sign this. No one has to tell me if this is good enough. If I say it's good, it goes out the door. Okay. And it is really quite liberating to be in that position.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were, as I say, brilliant together, because they're opposites in as much as Tony kind of, I don't think he disagrees with this, Tony does his thinking with his mouth. And Kim listens and chips in with things every now and then, and everything he says is worth listening to because he wouldn't have opened his mouth otherwise, whereas Tony kind of works it all out by talking and thinking and listening to other people. And so they were just brilliant together. So it was, coming up with... I mean, you may have a take on this. I've spoken to people in passing who've said they found it really hard to work there. What's your...
I only did a couple of weeks freelancing, to be honest. So I don't know, but I've known Tony. I knew Tony quite well around that time because Gabby was very good friends. We all worked in the same company as Tony's other half. So I saw Tony socially around that time a fair bit, and he was, as you said, well, whether it was talking with his mouth, whatever, he was one of the most energetic people who had huge creative standards. And I mean, there was a point actually where Steve Hudson got me and my art director to go and show them their book. When were you there when they were in Great Titchfield Street?
On the top floor.
And then, so we went to show them my book because, Steve thought it might be interesting if we went there. But we were already AMV, and I think it would be taking a bit of a risk at going to Wyden's, kind of regretting that right now. But going to see Tony and Kim with our stuff, they were just questioning everything and going, yeah, that is really good, but wouldn't it be even better if you did it like this, or if you tried it like this, or whatever. So you definitely got the impression that they were, you know, highly creative, highly energetic people with a great energy to succeed and go to different places. And I guess what that leads into here is Honda's advertising that I remember before Wyden and Kennedy was dreadful. And I can't remember which agency did it, and let's not name names anyway, but it was awful. So what I think is amazing is how they turned one of the unfancied car brands into an award machine, because, you know, you do it with VW, fine, you do it with Mercedes, fine, you know, even Volvo under David Abbott had a lot of really good work, but Honda was a bit of a dog. Were you there through the whole process of creating the OK factory and things like that?
Yeah. So that was my spot, the launch ad, which was great, because that was a pitch I wrote for the book Dreams, which won the pitch. And then it was generally felt that was a good summation of their philosophy, so should be the launch spot. So I then kind of thought of a visual that went with it. I mean, an odd way to do ads, really, just write a piece and then go, well, what on earth should we do for visuals? But I do remember speaking on one of the early shoots, I spoke with the client, again, whose name has rather been airbrushed from history, because he left within about 2 years of giving the account to Widens. He was called Chris Brown, I think. And he said, now, because I asked why did he necessarily pick us, etc.? And he said, well, we have a shared philosophy. Because we needed you to sort your shit out in London. We needed you as an agency to sort yourselves out, and we felt you were sorted out with your new management. But we have a shared philosophy, because we are the last and probably only independent car maker. Honda is independent.
Yeah,
which hadn't really occurred to me before, but I went, oh, well, of course. He said, you know, we don't own any other cars, and we have no intention of ever selling to another car maker. We are an independent global car maker. And Wideman Kennedy is pretty much the only independent global advertising network.
Yeah.
And he said, there was a philosophical fit. And so we just wanted to wait, as I say, until we felt you were headed in the right direction, and then we wanted to see what you were capable of. So we put you on a pitch. And, I mean, Tony and Kim made the brilliant decision in the pitch. We initially wanting to, I think this stuff is already known, but they initially wanted to change the end line, the Power of Dreams, because it sounds like it's almost the worst end line in advertising.
Yeah.
And I think they were getting ready to tell the client that. And then the more we all learnt about the company and their philosophy and crash course in what the hell Honda was, the more we realised that it was just a truly wonderful line, and it genuinely lived up to how they felt about things. And here's where it goes all hippy-dippy, and I don't mind that at all, because this was what we loved about them. They didn't care about this. When you have a dream, in life, anything, that dream just makes amazing things happen, from tiny things like waking up in the morning with songs in your heart because you are working towards a goal, which is, if anything, the secret of happiness anyway, through, you know, determination to overcome problems, and it all becomes infectious. You know, this working towards a dream becomes infectious to people around you. So this is the power of dreams. So we knew we weren't quite going to be able to work out in the, what was it, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, before, in the time we had before the presentation, exactly what the advertising would be. But this was their decision, Tony and Kim's, that we could at least start working out who they were as a brand, which was where the Book of Dreams came in. So we all started just chipping in on that, writing stuff.
And was that were Ben and Matt in the department at that time as well?
No, they came along, I'd say, about maybe 18 months later, something like that, maybe a year, 18 months. We hadn't really won anything significant by that point. The Honda pitch was maybe only, if memory serves, 3 or 4 months after Tony and Kim joined, maybe 6 max. So yeah, there hadn't been any significant account wins, really. So it was still a very, very small department. But people like Chris Groom was there from the very word go. And I love how he's still working for Widens now, albeit in America. So we just started writing, the creatives there, we just started writing stuff and thinking of visuals. And it was unearthing the truths of who they were. Mm-hmm. They have this, let me bore you with one incredible story. Every person who joins Honda as a company, is allocated a guy whose responsibility it is to see what their dream is in life. So after you've joined, 2 months after you've joined, you're asked to go into a room and sit down with this guy who's been allocated to you, and he says, what is your dream? And you have to give him an answer. you have to, right? If you don't have an answer, he says, I will see you again in 3 months when you give me an answer, right?
Yeah.
So let's say you say to him, well, my dream actually is to be a professional golfer or an airline pilot. He will then say, okay, excellent. I will see you in 6 months' time, and you will tell me what you have done in those 6 months to make that dream come true.
Wow.
Which, of course, probably means you'll leave their company.
Yeah.
You'll leave their company, because if you're going to pursue your dreams, well, your dream might not be working for Honda and designing cars or doing whatever it is you're doing at Honda. So they, it's like they mean this shit. It's not an end line. It's who they are. So we started to discover all this stuff about, you know, they really did wonder how to make everything better. And then it all started, which is why I'm a big believer in these brand books, as long as you do them properly, it all started to fall together, the tone of voice and, you know, lots of short, sharp lines and not really worrying about ad structures, which is why brand books are brilliant, because you're not writing ads, you're just writing something. You just want an idea or a thought or a fact or a truth. So we just started writing, and out of that came, and again, pardon me if people know this, but I've never really heard people talking about this stuff. We decided that what best summed them up actually was they were curious and inquisitive. So we wrote questions everywhere. We were writing questions, and we made a rule. In fact, I remember the day when we were all sitting in a group talking about stuff, and Kim said, right, we're going to make a rule. We're going to have a question in every single ad. Because the way we looked at it was, they had a car, the Civic, where they put the gear lever in the dashboard. Right, so this is, what is this, 2001? They came out with a Civic where the gear lever was in the dashboard, not down on the floor, but in the dashboard. And the way we saw it, if you said the new Civic comes with a gear lever in the dashboard, you as a consumer reading the ad would just go, what? Hey? Why? What's all that? I don't want that. What's all that about? But if you wrote as a sort of a line or a thought, why can't a gear lever be in the dashboard? You would start to think about it. Mm. You would be more open to the possibility of a gear lever being in the dashboard. So this all started to develop through the Book of Dreams. And again, I think the launch ad was this thing I did about, okay, I had this thought about, I just thought it was quite interesting that the most popular word in the world was okay. Mm-hmm. And it was a little then short leap to go, well, I wonder whether Honda would agree that the most popular word should be okay, because okay sounds very soft. Mm. Everything is all right. It's not bad. It's okay. And, so that was I was sort of working by myself, so I just did that one. Used a mad Japanese animator and put some music on it, and it just went out there, you know, this kind of weird ad with no car in it, but a philosophy. I do think sometimes when you're embarking on a big new campaign direction, certain first ads have to go out and pave the way.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They can't immediately be pounced upon. So I'm not saying this because I think it was the best ad. I think it was just a good start. It was superseded as an idea, I think, by many of the other ads. But it just had to go out, and same for the print. The print just started talking about products, bits within cars, talking about them, and the radio. So I wrote the launch radio as well, and that was the philosophy of the company. And it was, I mean, imagine the Honda themselves going, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, no, you can do all this stuff for like a year. that's really just talking about who we are. You know, this is not the car world that we know these days in advertising. It's metal. It's shoot the metal. And in print, show the metal and send everybody to the website. That's your only task.
Yeah.
So it was a breath of fresh air. Yeah.
And so I guess was there an overall plan that would be almost like the thing that would pave the way, and then here come the jazzier, more unusual. Although the first one was pretty unusual to have this happen, the OK Factory, but. Were the other ones waiting in place? Was there a 5-year plan, or was it just, okay, what's next?
No, not really, because we knew that every time we were asked to do something by them, there would be some kind of story that we would find, some truth, some insight, whether it was specifically about a car, whether it was a bit more philosophy, we would add the philosophy to the car. And we'd made a decision as a sort of group right at the beginning, that we really liked the idea that there was no visual style, that you would not have a clue what the next piece of work was going to be like, apart from one or two things, as I've already said, but I don't think anyone ever noticed, but that was fine, because you're not meant to, questions in every ad. And if anybody could ever be asked and look through the first, like, 8 years almost, every single ad in any media had a question. And then it was, again, right from the word go, we went, well, okay, we've got to talk to people. This has got to be a whole, like, 10 years worth of talking. We've got to talk. So we need somebody to do the talking. So we found a voice. And in fact, it was Russell Davis, the head of planning, who was listening to Garrison Keillor. I think he was listening to Lake Wobegon Days on his car stereo, the novel. And he suggested the Garrison would be an amazing voice, and of course he was. So I got to use him first in the OK Factory. And then everybody used him for all of the films. And he was splendidly hard work.
Can you explain that, please?
Well, yes, because he would give you 6 takes. It's like he lived in this little town in America, and he would just walk down into the main street, and he'd go into some studio, and they had, I can't even remember the name, like RDN or something. It would come down the line. But he was a bit, he didn't like advertising. Well, why would he? I mean, I'm sure he liked the money he was getting. But he was a bit contemptuous of us. Right. He is an entertaining philosopher,
yeah,
and author, and he has a radio show where he debates the issues of life, but it's all, so he felt that he was quite an intellectual, and I think he just really looked down on advertising. So he would give us 6 takes, and he would never, ever deliver the words the way you had heard them in your head. He would just not do it. And if you asked him to do it, he just wouldn't do it very well. So you had to just take what he gave you, really.
Yeah.
But what that meant was, and it was rather lovely, you had to embrace things that you thought were a bit wrong. You know this Wyden's thing of embracing, yeah, failure?
Yeah.
Well, that was part of it, was you would come back from a Garrison sound session going, I'm not sure we nailed it. But actually, no one out there would think that.
Right.
Nobody would think that. They would just hear his voice, hear his words. So it made you not stress about things being perfect. And in fact, rather enjoy the fact that they were imperfect. Because in advertising, everybody tries to make things so beautiful and right. And,
yeah,
you know, no glitches anywhere. Well, we had glitches with him.
Well, I think that's interesting because, you know, we sit there and go, are you obsessively, you know, there's a joke about Paul Belford that he was rotating full stops somewhere to make them exactly right and this kind of thing, and going on and being obsessive and looking. But the other ethos of it is the sort of giving some sort of freedom to other people. You know, when people say working with Frank Budgeon, if you had 100% of it nailed down, what's the point in hiring Frank? You need to nail down, say, 70% and let him do his thing. But you've got to have the courage that that 30% that he's going to add is going to be amazing and you're going to be okay with it. Otherwise, you know, either hire someone else or, you know, you're going to be in real trouble when you get the ad back. But what you're saying about Garrison sounds like kind of the way you ought to go, because in advertising, inevitably, you collaborate with a lot of people and you've got to give those people the chance to express their creativity. And when you don't, that's when problems happen.
Well, yeah, it can be a bit of a temptation in recording, when you're doing VO recordings, to basically read down the microphone how you want them to deliver it, which is kind of disrespectful, isn't it? And a bit stupid. And it soon became clear that we had to just really enjoy the fact that Garrison did it however the hell he wanted to do it. And that was part of his charm, was that he was saying hopefully interesting things that we'd written. And at the same time, he was delivering them in this voice like I've never heard from anyone else. And also a delivery that wasn't obvious. So it was great, but you had to go with it.
Right. I'd also say questions would normally show up by going, Japanese car company, English ad agency, American voice, how does that work? Because someone will have said, that doesn't make sense. Why have we got an American guy?
Now, I wasn't in the room when they sold him to Honda, but I would imagine, I'm not even sure Honda would have even said that to us, because they weren't really like that. But if they had done so, I'll bet Tony or Kim just said, well, look, listen to him, listen to how he talks. He will just stand out.
Yeah.
It'll just stand out. I mean, anyway, you know, it's the UK, you're Japanese. It doesn't, you know, your cars run everywhere. You appear everywhere. Yeah. You're a global company, even though you're Japanese. What does it matter that it's American? And listen to what it sounds like. And his whole kind of ruminatory sound as he said things just lent itself so well to the questions and the questioning and philosophizing a bit.
Well, it sounds like then from there you're in a really good position with where you could sort of leap off into what did become one of the most awarded campaigns of, you know, obviously of the century. So what happened next? What was the next stage in the campaign?
Well, it's worth saying though that a few films ran and we were getting a print look and feel going. So this is still early 2000s. There were one or two really, I mean, everything was interesting. That was the thing that I really noticed. They'd hired one or two more people now, so there were more people in the department. Ben and Matt joined, who I knew from the Burnett days. And I was able to say to Tony and Kim, you know, when they said we're going to see these guys for a chat, I was able to say, well, for God's sake, hire them because they're brilliant. And they did. And various films. I mean, back then, it was still film. It was still traditional media. It was films and TV and print and the occasional poster and radio. And yeah, there was some web activity, online activity that would go with certain films. But it was still trying to craft these amazing films. And of course, you've got clients who you go and see them with a 2-minute idea, and they go, "Oh, okay." I mean, it's extraordinary. I will never really see their like again. But by this point, it's worth also saying about Wydens and how they worked. I love, it's very loose. It's all quite loose. I mean, a planner would write a brief, but that brief was not set in stone. It was all up for grabs. So let's say there were a couple of teams on a brief, whether it's Honda or anything else, you'd all get in a room. Tony and Kim would be there, account guy would be there, traffic would be there, creatives would be there, planner would be there, and you would just start talking. So as a creative, you had to come to the table with something interesting. It didn't have to be an ad. Didn't have to be a fleshed out ad in any form, but you had to come with some thoughts that would be stimulating to the group. which was, you know, quite pressured, really, because you couldn't come with normal thoughts. You had to come with surprising thoughts that weren't ridiculous. And it's quite easy to be ridiculous. And I, you know, like everyone else, I had many moments where I talked about something that was turned out to be just bloody ridiculous and useless. But you had to just go for it. What would happen then was the conversation would start, and it was led by Tony and Kim, who would, and you would kind of talk about it, and it would start to make a bit of sense, and something that you'd mentioned or would then sort of mutate into something else. And the way everybody looked at it, this might sound all, again, all a bit sort of, I don't know, just a weird way of doing things, but the feeling was, and I loved this, that every review, the only purpose of a review, creative review, was to leave the room with everybody feeling we were closer to a solution. Didn't have to have a solution.
Yeah.
All you had to have was everyone feeling you were closer. And the way Kim used to refer to it was, it's like we're circling around the problem.
Right.
We're all circling around the problem. We're talking about it. We're using stimulus, and as long as we end the meeting feeling that the circle's got smaller.
Right.
And that we are slowly honing in on the thing. I just loved this. Because you could just, I don't know, I like the sort of backstory of ideas and where they come from and how you have to have the confidence to suddenly turn them into something else. So I loved all of this. And eventually, what it led to was, and it was brilliant for pitches, because you could be absolutely certain that after three or four meetings, you would have a solution. Because how could you not? You know, Tony and Kim, seriously smart people everywhere, you would end up with a solution. And then they had this thing called the wall. Did you see?
No.
You know, this part of, again, I love this. It was anything that was vaguely interesting, it didn't have to make sense there and then. It just had to have something about it that was making people go, God, you know, I think there's something there. We went on the wall. Bear in mind, we only had, at this point, there was just a boardroom. It was just a boardroom and then a whole load of desks all put together outside. There were no offices. It was just a boardroom and a space. So the boardroom was just used as the presentation room, and there was a big wall on it, and everything got stuck on the wall. And slowly, after all the reviews, you'd pull all these things off that no longer seemed relevant, and then something would leap out that suddenly was relevant, and it would turn into something else. So it was really scattergun, but everybody had to have the confidence that it would work. And if you did have that confidence in it, it always worked, just always did. So various films were made, some really brilliant ones. Not all, they didn't always, you know, take the world by storm. But anyway, a really solid body of interesting stuff every time. And then, of course, Ben and Matt come out with Cog. And I remember Ben asking me to have to check their first, to check an edit, a very early edit or something. And I remember saying to him, listen, please don't take this wrong. I don't want to see any of your work in progress, because I think this is going to be astonishing, this film. And I insist on seeing it like the rest of the world will see it. So I'm afraid I'm not here for you. I want to see it finished, done, like everyone else, because otherwise I will never really get that oh my God moment. So I do remember the day when they pulled me into a side room and said, okay, we'd like to show it to you. There was a little room called the Lucky Room. Right, it was the smallest room in the agency, and it was called the Lucky Room because I had two good creative reviews in a row in that room. And I said to someone, no, it wasn't the work, it's just a lucky room. So we called it the Lucky Room. So they took me into the Lucky Room and showed me the film, and they played it once, and of course it's astonishing. I still think it's the greatest advert commercial. It's the greatest commercial I've ever seen and ever will see. And they showed it to me once, And I said, listen, before I say anything, I must see it again. And so they played it again. So anyway, wonderful, wonderful stuff.
I was just going to say, when you were talking about Biactol, I was going to say, because I've given talks to my own agency about this, I consider COG to be the greatest product demonstration there is, because it doesn't work unless all the elements of the car work as they're supposed to work. Of course, it's not a conventional one, you see the car driving down the street, but what you do is the windscreen wipers work, and this pipe is calibrated the way it's supposed to be, and this happens and that happens. So to me, COG is not only one of the greatest ads of all time, but the greatest product demo, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I hadn't really thought about it like that, that you actually do get to see everything working. But you do, even though, like, the speakers vibrating and pumping at the end. So, again, it kind of works on you to make you, when they say, isn't it nice when everything just works, you're not having to make some really quite big leap back to the product and go, okay, I will believe you that that car is engineered as well as you say, which if you go away from the product, you will do so. I mean, to talk idea constructs for a second, which is a rather dull way of introducing it. There are, creatives are under pressure all the time, and we always tend to go for things that we know are going to work. Yeah. And also, it has to be said, constructs that we know win awards.
Yeah.
So the most popular construct for years and years, and it's still going strong, is to have a product story, write an end line for your product or brand story, and then reinterpret the end line without putting the product or the brand in it. So the classic, and this is a bit heretical what I'm now going to say, Sony Balls is just classic following this construct. It's okay, so the Sony television is brilliant colour.
Yeah.
Colour like no other. Okay, so we've got this line that applies to the Sony television. Yeah. Colour like no other. What we're going to do now, because after all, isn't it boring to do product ads, is we're going to interpret colour like no other in another way. We're just going to show you amazing colour. Now, I'm on dangerous territory here, because I'm not saying those kinds of ideas are easy, and therefore that astonishing film is just easy and no good. But the thing, and here's where I and Wyden sometimes risk becoming pompous about this. The quest for an idea or a thought that was utterly original was what really turned us on. And that wasn't just the idea, it was the construct to the idea. So you could have this idea, and you'd invariably say to someone, I've no idea how we're going to do it. I've got this thought, but I've no idea how it's going to work or how we're going to do it. And that would turn everyone on, because it was, well, okay, we're going to have to make this up then, because it hasn't been done before. Mm. So Ben and Matt and Tony and Kim going, well, let's do this using the car parts, and then you go, Jesus God, how are you going to make that work? What car parts? How are you going to work out what car parts to use and what to discard? And Jesus God, how are you going to make that work? So for them to pull it off like they did, I mean, So.
Well, it's interesting when you said the end line, retrofit the end line into another film. I mean, that's Heineken refreshes the parts other beers cannot reach, and that's good things come to those who wait as well, in that you then do a sketch that is tangentially a kind of exaggeration or a reinterpretation of what that line is that applies to the product. So yeah, you're right, it is a kind of, I don't want to say well-worn, because that sounds negative, and obviously it's produced some amazing work, but I think when we go into this Honda thing, you are looking at ad after ad that is a reinterpretation of the entire campaign. And when COG had come out, and I think Everyday and Sense were out around the same kind of time, and they were all very good, and COG, I think, was a whole, you know, level above. But to then go, okay, well, they've done brilliantly. They've taken this boring client that hadn't produced much good work up till now. Good for them. They've made one of the greatest ads of all time. To then, I'd say top it. You may modestly disagree with me, but I'd say top it with Gruer. I think is an even greater achievement than getting Cog out. I mean, to say Cog is amazing and everyone loves it, but hey, watch out, we're going to do something completely different to Cog and it's going to be just as good, if not better.
Well, thank you. I mean, we did very, very deliberately want to do something different again. Not, oh, well, let's follow the template, because we didn't want there to be a template. And if anything, one or two of the recent ads sent, you know, Everyday and Cog, etc., they've been amazing visuals, an amazing visual film with one line at the end wrapping it all up. And part of the thinking was, well, okay, let's not do that. Whatever happens, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something different, more writing. But, I mean, there is a story behind. Shall I, as briefly as I can, do the...
Yeah, go.
So, Chris Groom and I, Chris, brilliant art director, now works for Wyman Kennedy in Portland, we were given a brief to do a press ad. I think it was like a brochure ad or something for the new diesel engine. And so we went along to the Honda Institute. We wanted to go to the Institute to learn about it. We heard that there was this amazing new diesel engine. Well, why is it amazing? How amazing? So we went along to the Institute and we talked to a bunch of people and we were given a talk by this guy, this engineer. And that was where we first heard, Chris and I, about this whole thing of, well, he just hated diesels. He didn't want to do it. This Kenichi Nagahiro, I think was his name. And he'd refused for years and years to make a diesel, even though he was Honda's lead engineer in the world. And they kept going on him, kept saying, no, but Europe loves them. You've got to do it. And in the end, almost as a sort of, he bluffed them. He sort of said, well, okay, I will do it, but it's going to cost you a fortune and it's going to take years. Because I'm going to have to invent a new metal because diesels are heavy. So I'm not going to make you a heavy engine. So I'm going to have to invent a lighter metal that is as strong as what diesel engines currently are. I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to do that. It's going to cost you millions. Do you still want me to make this thing? They go, yeah. Okay, bugger. I'm going to do it now. Even as we were kind of sitting there, it was sort of occurring to us, well, I love, you know, we made the leap of, well, it was only because of his hatred, you know. We kind of talked about it as nothing ever changed through mild indifference. So we come back and we do this tiny little ad, and I think we were rushed, and actually it was a really average little ad, but it did start to talk about hate and love, and there was a heart in there and stuff, and how hating can make you love something because it changes, etc. Anyway, so it was sort of, the seed was sown. And then about 6 weeks later, 2 months later, a brief came in for the TV, and it was only me. It wasn't given to Chris. I would have thought we were both going to get the brief because we knew about it. We knew about the engine. But Chris was, I don't know why he wasn't put on it. I think he was either away or he was too busy. So it was just me put on the brief because Chris was busy, I think, and that was why he just wasn't available. And I'd kind of been thinking about it anyway because I knew we were probably going to, a TV brief was going to come in, a film brief. And I'd started to think about how this love and hate thing worked well together, and how, since songs were nearly always about love, wouldn't it be interesting to do a song about hate? And I had a kind of secret weapon, because I listened to Garrison Keillor's radio program, and he always would sing a song on his radio program, so I knew he could sing. So I'm going, okay, so great, this will lead to something that's different to the way everyone's been doing the other recent films as well, where it's a single line at the end of the film, Garrison. So at this point, I did, I think, in hindsight, a smart thing. I went, well, why would I want to do this all by myself? Michael Rusoff is a musician, so he was another creative. He brilliant creator. creative, brilliant ideas guy, and he writes his own songs. He noodles away on a guitar and records them. And so I said, Michael, do you fancy joining me on this? And he went, yeah, you bet. And then we did, both of us did a weird thing. We went, well, okay, why don't we ask someone else to join us? Why can't we have a team of three? So we kind of said to Sean Thompson, because we both knew just how brilliant Sean was. He'd been in the agency about 6 months, and he came on a sort of placement, and we just kept seeing these fantastic ads lying around the agency, and we kept saying to people, who's done that? And like traffic would say, oh, that's Sean Thompson. Yeah, he's just sort of helping us out for a few weeks. And eventually, Tony and Kim saw the light and said, okay, blimey, we need to give this guy a job. So Sean was on his own, Michael was on his own, I was on my own, and we just said, well, look, why don't we just do it together? So we did. And we know we're going to write the song, and it took 2 or 3 weeks to write the lyrics. It was hard, because, you know, we had to work out, well, how are we going to do this? What's this song going to be like? And, of course, we're idiots, because we're trying to write a song. You know, we're advertising creatives, for God's sake, not Ivan Novello. So we'll start with the words. So we would leave the agency, go to a coffee shop, and just sort of drink coffee and jam out lyrics. And eventually we had the lyric. Oh, meanwhile, of course, we'd had a review with Tony and Kim where we'd said, look, this is what we're planning to do. They went, great, okay, love it, go for it. But it took a while to write the lyrics. Eventually we've got the lyrics and we present them and everyone loves the lyrics. And at the same time, Michael had pulled out an old track. It was just a kind of basis of a bit of music, a bit of a tune thing. It didn't have any words to it. He'd never taken it anywhere, because we were determined that we were not going to use an existing tune.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all parts of this, again, yeah. Is it a bit pompous? I don't know. We were not going to do something that anyone else had done. So we went, right, we're going to have to write our own music as well. So he found this old tune he had. We added whistles to it, and then we went in and sang the song. I did the singing, and Michael played guitar to Tony and Kim, and they went, great. And they said, right, what are you going to do for the visuals? And we said, we've no idea. And so they had to go to the client and say, and this is why Honda were so remarkable, and say, listen, we've got an idea, it's great, but it's not ready. And they go, well, okay, you've had 3 weeks, but it's not ready. We'll let you know when it's ready. And it took another 2 weeks to write, may even have been more. And eventually we worked out that it just needed to be simple. We just needed to show bad engines being bad somehow, and then the good engine appearing and being good. You know, you can wrap yourself up in knots with your ideas, and it only started to work once we went, why isn't this working? Why? Because we had about 4 different creative reviews. We kept writing scripts that Tony and Kim turned down, quite rightly, visual ideas to go with these words. And eventually we worked out we just needed to see bad engine, then good engine. And that was when we went, okay, well, why don't we do this world? And we thrashed it all out. So it all gets approved internally. The client had to wait 5 weeks or something for it. And we go and present it to Simon Thompson, mm-hmm. and his second in command, the head of UK. And this was incredible. So we go there. Mike, you know, we say, so we've got an idea for you. Michael plays guitar, I sing, and Sean holds up all the storyboards and goes through the storyboards as we're going through the song. And so we just sing the song to them, and we just do one presentation, and then Simon Thompson gets up. He, like, pushes his chair back, gets up and says, I want you to go away and make this film exactly as you have shown it to me today.
Nice.
And that was the end of the meeting. Isn't that astonishing?
It is.
Yeah.
Well, I went to the ICA with Gabby one time, and I think Smith and Folks and Simon Thompson were there doing a presentation on Ongra and how it happened. And I think Simon went, did he go on to be the Cabaret's Gorilla client as well?
Or I didn't know that. He went on to Motorola.
Okay. Well, maybe it was that. But he seemed like a very interesting, smart, different guy. And I think, you know, it sounds like you've just got this great combination of factors that has led to, you know, what was a really, really good ad. The question I wanted to ask, because it's what makes your story unique. Your career up to that point, as we discussed in the first part, had, you know, some really good work, but maybe it wasn't as acknowledged as it could have been or whatever. But at this point, you're you know, around 18 years into your career. And then what hits is every creative's dream, that you create a spot that is not only it wins every award around the world, but I remember at the Creative Circle Awards when it won everything, I was singing it along with everyone else at my table, including a couple of people who were like, what the fuck are you singing the song from someone else's ad for? But it transcended, hey, fuck it, they won and we didn't, grumpy. Everyone just like, hey, it could be, you know, it can hate be good, can hate be great. And everyone knew the lyrics and it was all great. And I'm sure you've got a million stories about how the public loved it as well and that kind of stuff. What I want to know is, from a career which, you know, may not have been as acknowledged as it should have been or could have been, you then at I'd say a fairly distant point from the beginning become the most awarded creative of that year in the world. What's that like?
It was a bit surreal. It was a wonderful joyride. And this will sound a bit... I've had some of my most melancholy evenings at awards dues. And at awards dues where I've won things. Because, I don't know, there's something about it where you go... It's not that you're necessarily already thinking about what you're going to do next. But it's... I've had what I think is a kind of an odd career, you know, down the mines, etc. And there was a little... If I'm very honest with you, there was a little bit of me... sort of just thinking to myself, oh yeah, well, where were you 10 years ago when I was doing weird shit for Gordon? There was a little bit of that going on, and it's a little bit like you don't believe when people say you're no good, and you shouldn't believe it when people say you're wonderful. You should try and stay somewhere nicely in the middle. You know, so it was great. And I do remember at Cannes, coming back off the stage and sitting down with Sean and Michael and sort of leaning across to them, even as, you know, people were still singing and the applause was still ringing out, and sort of saying to them, right, okay, boys, our task now is that this is not the best year of our lives. And I do think I probably singularly failed. But I'm glad that, you know, I didn't want to just ride on its coattails forever.
If memory serves, that year it won at DNAD was, and the very night of DNAD was when Liverpool beat AC Milan in the European Cup final. And Tony, I know, is a Liverpool fan. I assume you're a West Ham fan, so it wouldn't be the same. But I'm just thinking, if you could have written that as a script to say. I mean, obviously the Liverpool match on its own was ridiculous, but to add the Liverpool match to it being on the night of DNAD when, what did you, was it two or three black pencils or something? Or I didn't, whatever it was. And well, then
it was, again, you see, I have to watch it here because previously in our conversation, I've been talking about how awards are a bit dangerous and, you know, the pursuit of them is all consuming and it's a bad thing. But it was a total of, 8 silvers and 2 golds, yeah, which was obviously wonderful. And to win I still think DNAD is really, should be the only thing that matters. So to win a gold and to win, frankly, to win 2, I mean, it was just surreal.
I mean, we could say good and bad things about awards, but yeah, you obviously having an evening like that, which is, one amazing career in a night, because if you had that, I freelanced sitting opposite Sean at 180 for a while, and we had a few good chats and whatever. And he had all his pencils there, and I've taken a photo of them. I think I put them on Instagram. He has something like 23 silver pencils and two golds, and it literally no one else I've seen has got anywhere near that. I remember once when I was at college, we went to see John Gorse and Nick Worthington at BBH, and along the top of their shelf was something like 15 yellow pencils, because obviously they each had their own yellow pencils for all the Levi's print work they did, and then Creek and Drugstore. And then when I went to AMV, Tom and Walt's top shelf was similarly heaving with yellow pencils, and there was something kind of magical about them, and magical about how difficult they were to win. And now they give so many more away, because you can get like digital craft cinematography, and you can get, you know, there's probably 50 pencils a year where there used to be 10 or whatever. But I think at that point, it was probably one of the last times when DNAD was still DNAD. I don't want to denigrate DNAD too much, but I think it's changed a lot in the last 10 years. But at that point in 2005, it was still the kind of absolute pinnacle of what you could do. And winning one gold in your career is one thing, but winning two in one night, amazing.
So I love that it happened, and I guess it did set me up for jobs, and it did keep me going, and that's great. One thing worth mentioning, there was a curious that once we'd made it, once it had been finished, it took too long to make,
right?
Because it's quite complicated and complex, and it took too long. So we had missed the air date. So, you know, because Honda used to do these things whereby they'd really only run the big films a few times, invariably at half time in the Champions League semi-final or something. And we'd missed our slotted air date for whatever it was, Champions League semi-final or quarter-final, whatever. So we had to sit on it for about 2 months before it ran. And during those 2 months, we really had no idea what we'd got. Because there was this thing, and it was 90 seconds long, and it was a song, and it was weird, and there were these visuals, and whack and thrum and hum and pop and clatter, and we really didn't know whether anyone would like it, or get it, or understand it, it sounds like I'm sort of fishing, oh, that's ridiculous, Richard, but honestly, we didn't know what we got, and it is because... And I know I go on about this originality thing. When you do something, so we got this thing, and all we knew was that it was new. It hadn't been done before.
Right.
And we were so thrilled at its newness. But it meant that we had no frame of reference, nothing to go by. We hadn't, you know, forgive me having another pop at Sony Balls and the like. We hadn't done a construct that was an end line that you reinterpret and do the visuals completely without. So we're just going, oh, well, I hope people get it. And I do remember I sent it to Neil, probably a bit before I should have, actually, Neil Dawson, because you're not meant to release these things, are you? But I sent him it because I wanted to know what he thought. And he wrote an email back immediately that just said, right, you've got to get your name out there. You have got to get in touch with Campaign. You have got to... And I didn't know what he meant. I didn't understand what he was talking about. And I had to write back and go, what do you mean? What, do you like it? Of course I bloody like it, you fool. What I'm saying is people have got to know you've done it. Because I didn't really then, and don't really now, have much of an interest in keeping a public, an industry profile. I do kind of think the work will just speak for you. So it was all odd and wonderful at the same time.
And like you're saying, I mean, I think part of the melancholy of it, an awards do, is partly once it's won the award, that really is the end of the appreciation thing. You're not going to get any more stuff from it. Yeah, that's it. That's when that's the final kind of element. So maybe that's a slightly melancholy bit. So you then have to, whether you feel like you're going to top it or not, what's it like going back to work, you know, under the kind of glow of GRU?
Yeah, well, the odd thing was that circumstance had actually dictated that I actually left White friends immediately. I didn't really have a period where I went back and we all basked in the joy of it. I'd moved on. I got a job in Amsterdam at Wydens.
All right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was nice to kind of go out there and, you know, be the guy who'd done this and stuff. But it was a shame, really, because it was a bit like I didn't really get to properly enjoy it with my colleagues and everything. Because literally, as it came out, as it was finished, I'd moved on. Yeah.
I wondered if you wanted to tell everyone else the story you told me when we met in October. That was the when you were showing Tony and Kim work, and you said to them, "You just want to see absolutely amazing work every time," and they said, "Yes, you get it now," or something like that. Do you want to talk about that or not?
That's right. It was beforehand when I was doing different things for other products that were other brands, and also kind of about halfway through my period there, my time there. I was there about 4 years, 4.5 years. I did the banana ad for Honda as well, press ad. So things were going, I sort of had a really good year with banana and a few other things. And then I had a bit of a fallow period where things weren't quite coming off. And it was like I wasn't quite necessarily, things weren't going through. And I guess maybe I wasn't coming to meetings with stuff that was stimulating, because you had to. So maybe I wasn't. But anyway, I was being given a bit of grief, quite a lot of grief by Tony and Kim, that I needed to pull my socks up. And this was after, you know, a really quite amazing time. It was before GER, but there was other stuff going on. Anyway, and I said to them, why? I sort of said a bit facetiously, "Oh, have I got to be brilliant every single day?" And they said, "Yes, you do." And I thought that was the most fantastic answer, because of course I always wanted to be in a place, work in a place that demanded brilliance from me every day. And you can't deliver it, but you needed to understand that there was no coasting. I mean, I just thought that was the most, I loved them for saying that straight back to me and kind of making me go, "Oh yeah, God, shit, they're right. Okay, back to your desk, Russell, get on with it." But I mean, it was, again, I will, you know, there are certain agencies, you'll know what I mean by this, Ben, certain agencies where you view those agencies as home.
Right.
That was your, you know, you will have them, everybody has them. The place that was your spiritual home. And Wydens absolutely was that. And, you know, that the banana ad, to go into a creative review with a piece of fruit that I'd scribbled on and show it to my creative director. And I remember, and maybe I told you this before when we met a few months ago, so I showed Tony and Kim this banana with words on it, and Tony says, "Right, Richard, I do not know when this ad will run, but I promise you it will run. Leave it with me." I have never worked anywhere where your creative boss made that kind of statement to you. Isn't that what every creative wants? To just feel that someone is now just going to fight your corner because you've delivered your half of the bargain, part of the bargain, and now the agency is going to do the other part. And so, wonderful. Yeah.
Cool. And then, so, if you're at Wydens Kennedy Amsterdam, what happened then and after that?
Yeah. There was a guy called Carlos Bayala, who was the ECD out in Amsterdam, and I fancied a bit of an adventure. And also, I wasn't CDing anything in London. I was just writing after, which was great, of course, but I kind of fancied running a few things as well. So he gets me out there and he resigns on the day I arrive. Isn't that brilliant? Literally, I arrive on a Monday, and then in the afternoon someone says, "Oh, there's an agency meeting. Come along, there's an agency." And Carlos stands up and says, "So I'm moving and I'm setting up Mother in Brazil or something." So, and he was gone. And it was, unfortunately, I only stayed there 9 months. I was going out and staying for 5 days in Amsterdam and then coming back on the weekends. And I was running Vodafone, which was a thankless task. And I helped. I mean, I won a pitch or two and things. So it was a great experience. But it was a slightly curious place because it didn't really have the standards, the creative standards that London did.
Right.
It had a few accounts that were its cash cows, and it was odd. I thought this was a culture that was going to be in every single office, but it wasn't quite like that. I think maybe it's much better now, but it wasn't quite like that then. So I came back, and we can kind of whiz through all of this, actually, because I am not impressed with the last 8 to 10 years of my career. because I liked running things as well as making things and writing things and thinking of things. I really did enjoy building relationships with clients, working with other creatives, helping their ideas to come to fruition. I really liked it and still do. But I look back now and realize I just got caught up in sort of, there's only so much you can do within that world. And I entered a kind of a Europe and global world, running accounts across Europe and globally, and man, that's a whole different ballgame. So very quickly, it was Ogilvy & Mather. I came back from Amsterdam too. Stayed there about 2 years. I wasn't being used properly, and I didn't really like it there. So moved on to Saatchi's to run Toyota. Somebody rang me up and said, "Are you interested in running PlayStation?" TWA. And I said, no.
Why?
Because this was at the same time I was just about to join Saatchi's and run Toyota across Europe. And I said, well, if I run PlayStation, I am just the latest in quite a long line of brilliant creative directors to come out with brilliant work on a brilliant account. Whereas I could turn round Toyota.
Yeah.
That's a really significant thing. So I would rather the problem of Toyota, thanks, which of course was a really stupid decision. It was impossible, and I was kind of left to my own devices by the agency, not really supported, and the clients had incredibly strong views about how to do things, and they tested everything, and it was an unwinnable gig. And then I decided it was time to put my money where my mouth is, and I should run a department because I wanted to do that. I wanted to test myself and, you know, try to bring to life the philosophies of how to run a place and that I believed in. And I absolutely chose the wrong place. It was a place called Nitro, and they were in terrible trouble, but nobody told me.
Yeah, they don't, do they?
No. And I joined, and within 2 months of joining, my managing director partner left, and somebody was put in above her, and the head of planning who I joined was let go after 3 months. It was all just, you know, and there was no money to do anything, and my creative department got smaller and smaller. Anyway, so that was all horrific. So I left there, mutual agreement. I'd had enough of the pain. And I did a bit of freelancing for Neil Dawson, who was running Philips at DDB. So I went over to help him out on a project and was kind of wandering around the corridors doing a few things. And somebody said, oh, Richard, you're here, are you? You couldn't help out with something, could you? And next thing I know, I'm hired to run Unilever's... I had the greatest job title in advertising. International Creative Director of Ice Cream. Now, that is as good as it gets, yes. I think. But, of course, again, reality wasn't like that. Unilever and... See, creatives have a problem. Most creatives have a problem. We genuinely believe that hard work, enthusiasm, smarts, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
It'll be okay. We're innocent and naive and frequently ignorant of the big bad world, and I couldn't make the things happen that I needed to make happen. So that ended after about 18 months. I think I just, you know, I pushed the client so much they didn't want me to work for them anymore. And you go, okay, well, great, because we're not achieving anything. But then the last thing, and this brings us up to date, DDB kind of kept me on, and I sort of morphed into becoming the global creative director for McDonald's.
Okay.
So the last 4 years, now that I've stopped doing it, I look back on it as kind of just weird, wasted time. I've met wonderful people, worked with wonderful people, and so I was the troubleshooter around the network. Yeah. I would help offices try and instill standards and brand understanding and help people with pitches on separate stuff, not just McDonald's, but also help them with McDonald's. And I entered, and of course, the money is very seductive. Very seductive.
I'm sure.
You know, global CDs on stuff. But you enter this weird world of conferences and agency initiatives and planes and executive washrooms. It's a weird world, and you're actually too detached from the work. You're not able to properly get a grip on something to make something happen. Even though you're helping people all over the place and hoping it's making a difference. And I'm not sure it did make a difference. Because we weren't good enough as a network properly in every office, we started, and McDonald's as a brand became in trouble. You know, share price, spent 15 years doing that. Now all of a sudden it was doing that. And McDonald's started doing something they had never, ever done before, which was have pitches. They were all loyal to their three agencies, TBWA, Leo Burnett, and DDB. And DDB had more markets than anybody else, the other two. But there would be pitches. And I'd kind of been saying to my management colleagues, we're not good enough in certain places. We've got to do something about it. And nothing was ever done. And sure enough, we would lose the pitches. So all of a sudden, agency losing money, McDonald's having a terrible time. And I became Matthew Letizia. I became the unnecessary creative midfield supremo. I was a creative luxury, I think. That's my take on it. I was just, because the other two agencies didn't have an equivalent of me. So.
Well, I think everyone should have and value a Matthew Letizia personally. He was one of my favorite players because he just did the most incredible things and made them look like he basically had a pint and a fag in his hand while he was doing them. And if particularly if there's a free kick, maybe I'll put it on the blog when I put this up, that got rolled back to him. He just flipped it up in the air and then twatted it one first time into the goal. And I'd never seen a free kick like it. And he just used to do that. Anyway, we don't have to talk about Matt Letizia, but I think more Matt Letizias would be a good thing.
Well, yeah, and he was picked for one England game by Hoddle.
Ridiculous.
Where he hadn't been picked for like 30 games, and suddenly Hoddle put him in out of position in a really important European Championship qualifier. He didn't have a good game and he was never picked again. They never work out how to use their creative players anyway.
No. Can I ask you about the book? Quickly or slowly or whatever. How did that come about, and are you a big golf nut? And
yes, as soon as I realized I started playing when I was about 8, and as soon as I realized you didn't have to wear shorts, I thought, this is the sport for me. What sport in long trousers? Count me in. And it is, I've played it for years and years and years, and it is the greatest. I mean, I'm a football nut, and I kind of wish I'd been a footballer. I think I should have been a footballer, but that's a conversation for another day.
Okay.
But golf is so deliciously difficult. You can never beat it. It doesn't really matter what your handicap is. You can never win against it. It will always come challenge you. And, and the fact that it's not a moving ball, it just sits there. Do something to it.
Yeah.
So your head messes you up and you think too much and all this. So over the years, I just kind of got lots of thoughts about golf and heard lots of amazing true stories, and I kind of had sort of opinions about it and stuff. So I thought, I'll write the golf book I've always wanted to read but never found. No one's ever written this book. Again, all going back to let's try and write a book that no one has done before.
Yeah.
So I just filled it with the stuff that I thought was great and people would be interested in if there were other people like me that they would want to read about it. Things like no one ever talks about losing your temper on the golf course.
Sure.
So I thought, right, I'm doing a chapter on club throwing. Because it's like the great taboo. No one ever talks about club throwing and how insanely annoying this game is. So I did a chapter on club throwing, and I thought, okay, every time you see swing sequences in magazines, it's always a swing sequence of a, you know, Ernie Els, see how he swings back frame by frame, Ernie Els. I thought, wouldn't it be quite funny to do different swing sequences of how to throw clubs? Different club throws. So I kind of did illustration stuff. So I have a long journey into work because I live out in the country. So it's an hour and a half on the train to get into London. So I thought, okay, you've got 3 hours a day to write. So I just started writing on the train, and then I'd written about a couple of chapters, and you know that naive, ignorant thing, optimistic thing? At this point, I thought, okay, well, I think it's coming along splendidly. I think it's probably time to alert the publishing world. So I did my homework, and I worked out who to contact, who might be the right publishers. I wrote six letters to six publishers, and I thought, well, frankly, if I can't sell, after 25 years in advertising, if I can't sell my own passion project, I don't deserve to be a copywriter. So I kind of wrote about it in a way that I thought would be seductive. Four of them said no. Two of them said maybe. One of them said actually no. And the other one said, yeah, okay, here's a couple of grand to finish it off. And then 9 months later, they published it. And I've since learned that never happens, that you can't do that. I mean, this is the world you know because you wrote your book, and indeed, it arrived today.
Oh.
On Amazon, yeah.
Enjoy.
So it was, and it was a huge success, and, well, I say huge success, it sold about 10,000 copies, which I was told for a very odd hardback book about golf was a huge success, and it won a little award and has been reprinted a couple of times, and it came out again as a sports classic a couple of years ago. So I feel like I should write another one.
Yeah.
But the thing I wanted to ask, I found the writing of that book to be really easy. Right, really easy.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to say stuff and I just said it, and it took a few months and then I stopped and I'd done it. You wrote a novel. You wrote a fiction book where every page had to serve a purpose to the next page, and you had to paste your plot and you had to develop characters. And I have to say, I mean, I've been writing for all my career. I'm not sure I could write a novel. I'm not sure I would know how to do it. And hats off to you is what I want to say.
Thanks very much. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've just read a bunch of them and then wrote one that seemed like one of the ones I'd read. And I think, as you may find, if you've read anything by Michael Crichton, you'll see his fingerprints all over my brain somewhere. And movies like Alien and whatever. So I thank my brother in the back of my book, partly because he got me into movies and the construction of movies at a very early age. And I was watching really good films, probably a bit earlier than I should have done, given their certificate. But I think I just had the construction in my head somehow of, you know, the rhythms and that kind of stuff. That's not to say in any way I'm suggesting it was easy or anything like that. I don't know. And there was a point where I couldn't work out the second half and left it for a couple of years and that kind of thing. But
so you hadn't mapped out the narrative?
No, I think I just started, because there's kind of a couple of ways you can do it. You can just kick it off and see where it goes, Because I think, again, with the going back to the Frank Budgeon, what do you hire him for thing, you kind of need to keep that looseness in there. But otherwise, you can know the ending, or otherwise, you can create a skeleton and then just add the flesh and the veins and the muscles and whatever to that skeleton. And I'm currently writing a TV series in my spare time with Gabby. And we outlined every episode, and I'm just now writing the scripts for every episode. Again, it's a creative exercise. But I've never written a TV series before. I'm just kind of, I think this is how it's done. I've read a bunch of TV scripts, et cetera, et cetera. Let's see how it goes. But I think you've just got to do it and have it come off. And I think for a lot of people, it doesn't. But look in Waterstones at how many books there are. There are lots of people who can, you know, marshal those 100,000 words into a place that they're supposed to be. But I don't know. There's as many ways to do it as not do it, I think.
Yeah, and I guess the advice you're always given is, well, write.
Yeah, Start writing.
Here I am saying to myself, wow, that whole novel malarkey, I think that's going to be really tough. Well, I've never
written a
single word of a novel, so how would I really know?
Well, and I should just do it. The other aspect of it, that whether you're writing a screenplay or a novel or whatever it happens to be, there's what is called the vomit draft, where you just get all your stuff out, however crap it may be, and then you've got something to fix. And that's much, much, much easier than having a blank piece and going, wow, how do I make this perfect? And how do I make that plot turn amazing and whatever? You don't know until you start, until you go, because you can never know. Exactly. So say your character pulls up at a bank and goes in and robs the bank. What car is he pulling up in? How many people are around that bank? What's he wearing? How many people are inside the bank? What are the alarm systems like? You can't know any of that until you get into it. So you've just got to write.
I guess, how much of that do you need to add?
Yeah. There's no definitive answer to that. You can describe it. If you read the Game of Thrones novels, they describe every single thing in minute detail, and yet are still very, very entertaining and have a huge momentum, and they're very page-turny, which is kind of weird. But then you could read something very sparse by someone like J.M. Coetzee, where he may not describe quite as many things, but it still works. So, like I said, there's as many right answers as wrong answers.
Yeah, and I guess you can't discover how you want to do it until you start writing.
Yeah.
Until
you have a thing, you don't know what it's going to look like and what it's going to be and how it's going to, you know, manifest itself. So I guess the thing with your golf book, you started and it ended up somewhere. And it ended up somewhere people wanted to buy and read, and that's great. But maybe what was exactly in your head, you might have gone, right, let's have the club throwing chapter, but you may not have gone, here, have the diagrams of the club throwing, or you may have, I don't know. But,
as it
went ahead, more things probably became revealed to you. The onion layers.
Well, that's absolutely how it was. Yeah. Which is, of course, how it all ties back as well to, you know, our advertising backgrounds of you get going and then these little ideas pop into your head and go, okay, well, I'll add that as well. And so nothing stays as planned.
Yeah, and it's partly that first thought thing. I mean, it's almost like that insulting thing. Oh, it's a bit first thought, because you need to write to get that crap out of your head so that you've got the good stuff underneath that you wouldn't have got to unless you'd push past the initial things that everyone already knows.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm never entirely sure that the get your crap first thoughts out of the way is true. Or to put it another way, I think there's another way of looking at it.
There is.
That sometimes your very first instinctive thoughts are powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it may be how you interpret those thoughts, because you might go, right, hate something, change something. But then it may take you weeks to go, let's have a jingly song that does that, as opposed to going, hey, why don't I just have someone stand in front of a camera going, I hate things, so I want to change them. So I don't know. But you're right that the instinct may give you the first kernel, the seed. Cool. Okay. Well, I've gone way over the I mean, it probably won't. I'll probably put it on two episodes or whatever, like I seem to normally do, until I sort out my IT better.
We're making life hard for you again.
That's fine. I almost feel like there is more stuff to discuss within the stuff we've already discussed, but I think let's leave it there, and we'll see what we can talk about in the future. But it's been a huge pleasure, Richard, and thank you very much for taking the time.
Well, absolutely. The pleasure's mine as well. And it's a satisfying but curious thing to talk about yourself and career like this. And it does, I think, tempt you to occasionally be a bit self-congratulatory. So I hope that hasn't happened too often.
I think with some of the ads you've done, you can certainly justify a bit of self-congratulation as much as lots of other people could in the industry anyway. So I wouldn't worry about that.
Okay.
Thanks,
Richard. It's been a pleasure. It's a shame we never work together.
Well, you never say never.
I'd love to be in an apartment with you.
This may happen at some point. You never know what the future holds.
Okay, well, I'll have to come out to LA then.
If you must, please. The weather's lovely over here right now, so do that.
It's a deal. Leave it with me.
Okay. Cheers, Richard, and say hi to Trish. Okay.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye, Richard.
Bye.